This is episode 2 of Futures Intelligent Leadership Flowcast with today's guests, Shanoa Farnsworth, managing partner of Blue Startups in Honolulu, Hawaii, and Dr. Catherine Hall from Harvard Medical School. Welcome to the Futures Intelligent Leadership Flowcast. This is your host, Tyler Mongan. I'm the president of Haku Global. This is a space for globally minded experts to dialogue about the future of leadership with a focus on the key question, how can leadership be more intelligent about futures? From their conversations, innovative wisdom, practical tools, and actionable insights emerge to help future-ready leaders thrive in an uncertain, complex, and exponentially changing world. Let's jump in to the dialogue. Welcome to today's episode. I wanted to see what would emerge when the managing partner of a startup incubator dialogued with a Harvard medical professor about futures intelligent leadership. Today's guests are Shanoa Farnsworth and Dr. Catherine Hall. Shanoa is the managing partner of Blue Startups in Honolulu, Hawaii, which provides investment, mentorship, and workspace for high-growth technology startups. She is also the managing director of Hawaii Angels, Hawaii's only angel investing network. She has a wealth of experience in helping startup executives transform ideas into market-relevant and investable products and services. Now, Dr. Catherine Hall is an assistant professor at Harvard Medical School, and she is studying the genetic effects of the placebo response. So if you want to find out how to build ideas that are market-relevant, how the placebo effect can hinder or help leadership, how to walk the fine line of delusion and competence, what we can learn from the Theranos failure, how to strip bias out of the equation of your ideas, the value of doubt, how to avoid the Hawthorne effect, and how being honest as a leader can empower others, then you will enjoy today's dialogue. Let's listen. I want to start with this key question that we're addressing on this Flowcast. What does it mean for a leader to be intelligent about the future given uncertainty, complexity, and exponential change in this world? I'd like to start with Shanoa, if you can start. And you know, what are your thoughts on that question?
Aloha, Tyler. Thank you for having me. We work with a lot of entrepreneurs at Blue Startups. So I think the future is what we're always aiming at, right? You've heard the phrase, we're working with entrepreneurs who are looking around the corners. So I think that's something that ideally we're looking for as well, and that the entrepreneur is not building a solution for today, but they're building a solution for tomorrow. And that's something that is tricky, right? It's a hard timing issue to get right. You can be ahead of that curve or you can be behind it. Getting that timing just right is a difficult task for anyone. But I think it is something we look for, and it's something that is really critical to success in our industry.
Thank you, Shanoa. And Dr. Hall, what are your thoughts on this? I know in your field, it's a little bit different. It's not directly related to leadership, but I think there's a lot of crossover, especially with this idea of your work with placebo.
Tyler, thanks for having me today. You know, it's a really interesting question, and I work on a macromolecular level, if you will, with patients and thinking about the placebo response, but I also do a lot of work on a molecular level with genes and proteins. And, you know, I always think of, you know, us as human beings on a macro level as being situated in our families, well, I guess first in ourselves, in our families, our homes, our communities, and our nation states, and then globally and basically universally. And I think, to me, awareness not just of, you know, what's ahead and what's, but also of what's behind, and also your place in that whole ecosystem. And I think, you know, I think I look for leadership to have a certain level of self-awareness and an understanding of the leader as a leader in the context of all that we need to do and all that we have done. And so I think, you know, if you think of it as a network, I think if a leader thinks of themselves as part of this network of human beings on these on our planet, I think that's, to me, that's the first place to start.
Great. And Chinoa, with your work, following up on what Catherine says here, how do executive startups kind of think that way, where they're kind of connected not just to the future, but also to their past and kind of this bigger network?
Yeah, well, I think, you know, for entrepreneurs, like the most important thing they can do, right, is get, as we say, get out of the building. Because anytime that you are developing a product in isolation of having a conversation with first your customer, but, you know, secondly, the market in general and your network, and just we encourage them to talk to as many people as they possibly can and get as much information as they possibly can. Because of course that informs the product that they're building and creates a product that actually has, you know, market demand kind of built right in. Often we find entrepreneurs that kind of lock themselves in a cave and develop something they think the world wants. But when they go and launch it, they discover, oh, actually the world didn't want that. I've just wasted 6 months of my life. So having as many conversations with as many people and really kind of crowdsourcing the idea even before they start is really the best approach that they can take to building product. And they'll, I always tell them, you'll never be steered wrong by talking too much about your product to too many people. I think entrepreneurs tend to be paranoid about what they're building and think they need to fly under the radar or build in stealth mode or all of these things, which I think, frankly, are do them a huge disservice more often than not. So really, you know, getting the idea out there and populating it with as many stakeholders as you can leads to a much better result.
Catherine, with your work, I mean, it seems like with Chinoa, we're talking here also about this idea of a, you know, a startup is building something in their head first, in their mind, before it becomes a reality. You know, connecting with other people and talking, getting information is important, so you can feed the mind the insights it needs to create the product that's relevant to the market. But there's also this work you're doing with like placebo and how our mind is kind of is actually creating things that that could seem impossible to some people. Can you talk a little bit about that, how that could relate to this idea of executive startups and creating, taking dreams and making them reality?
Yeah, that's a really interesting kind of juxtaposition there. I haven't ever thought of it in that context. But when you think about placebo responses, there's a lot of question about whether or not they're real or they're imagined. And more we're starting to understand that there are real changes in the brain that occur when you, you know, give a patient a treatment that happens to be pharmacologically inert. And so I think some of that is absolutely real. And then some of it is kind of the product of what you imagine, right? So we found that if you expect to get better, you're more likely to get better. And so I guess, you know, it's interesting because if you juxtapose that with the reality of business, you know, your expectations of what might happen with your product, the thing you've worked on and kind of created, and the market don't always correspond, but certainly in your head, you know, and your belief system, what you believe tends to be true to you until kind of reality hits. So I think it's a really interesting intersection to think about. An entrepreneur has to live in the real world, and you know, obviously it's not about them. And I think that's probably the point at which you can see that a good leader is one that I think can understand what's going on within them and put it in the context of what needs to be done or what is happening outside of them. If, for instance, if you take the placebo example, if you're feeling better because you took this inert pill, I think it's really important for you as an individual to understand that that doesn't mean that everybody can take a placebo and feel better. That, you know, just as you want to individualize and take into consideration what each person is telling you in as you think through your business plan. I think it's the same thing if you flip it from the perspective of the physician. They really need to think about what works for an individual patient. Sometimes it might be a placebo, and sometimes they need the real pharmaceutical agent.
And Chanel, can you add to that at all? It's like, it seems like there's this idea that the entrepreneur, the executive, startup, even a leader in some sense, when they're creating visions, is they're kind of creating this dream in their mind, but it's part of it's real and part of it's just a product of their imagination.
Right. Yeah. I mean, we always say that, entrepreneurs walk a fine line, between delusion and competence, right? And so it really is striking that balance. And, we want our entrepreneurs to be competent, but not delusional. And often, entrepreneurs, and that's kind of a personality trait, right? I mean, if you weren't delusional, you wouldn't start a company. Most companies fail, right? Most companies go out of business. So you kind of have to tell yourself a certain tale and believe it wholeheartedly in order to move ahead, even to just get off of square one. Because if you just looked at, again, the data and the statistics, well, you wouldn't start anything. Because, probability is that you won't succeed. So you have to think you're kind of this extraordinary human, and that, of course, your vision is that much better, or your ability to execute on the vision is that much better than anybody else. And those personality traits have, a plus side and a minus side, right, to them. So, because then you can get into a situation where you put blinders on and you don't see, certain evidence that's right in front of you, because you believe so wholeheartedly in your vision and your product and your company that even though the world may be, yelling at you, we don't like it, or we need you to change it in this way, or you need to approach it differently, you're kind of not hearing it because of those blinders that you've put on as a part of kind of this delusional thinking that's somewhat required, right, in order to move ahead.
Yeah, it reminds me of the Ranos organization that built a, basically a multi-billion-dollar dream that didn't become a reality. And at some level, an executive startup is doing this all the time, but, the ones that end up succeeding in making it a reality, then they're never looked on as, failing. But there's many and many that fail and never become real and try to sell a dream to people.
Theranos very, very, easily could have become a huge success,
right,
just as well as it became a huge failure.
Yes.
So, that could have definitely gone either way.
Yeah.
And so her absolute unwavering belief in the company and their ability to succeed wasn't necessarily the thing that got them in trouble. Was just kind of the necessary component to even get her to take that leap of faith in the first place.
Yeah, and get to the point where they could even attempt to do what they wanted to do.
Mm-hmm.
And Dr. Hall, with your work, placebo, again, going back to that, like how could, as we're talking about this idea of imagination and dreaming and making things real, how could leaders or, entrepreneurs or startup execs, how could they use this idea of placebo to their advantage?
Well, it's very interesting to think about the pharmaceutical industry in 2020, which is fast approaching. The way placebos have played out in drug development is really interesting because they, early on after World War II, when people realized that they needed to control for these nonspecific effects that they were finding when you gave people a treatment, in order to really be able to see if a drug worked or not, they introduced placebos into clinical trials. And as it has turned out in the last 20 years, in some indications, there's an increase, and it continues to increase, according to some data, an increase in the placebo response rate. And, to Chinoa's point, what that means is to make a drug in some indications where there is a high placebo response, you have to almost put blinders on, you know, because if you really looked at the percentages of companies that are successful in making a new drug in some of these highly placebogenic conditions or diseases, you probably would say, no, I can't do it. What I think buoys people along is they have a compelling mechanism of action, right? So they understand the nature of their pharmaceutical agent. They have incredible safety data, and they have maybe some preliminary data that this drug is going to be effective. And unfortunately, when they do a large clinical trial, the drug does very well, but so does the placebo. And what's ironic is that a lot of these drugs just get shelved. And so, you know, I think in a way, this has always been our way to put the blinders on and to have the people who can kind of navigate through the doubt. Because if you're lucky, you will get through that, you know, that chasm. But not everybody, as Chinua pointed out, makes it through. So I think placebos are definitely playing havoc on drug development in our present day, which is not quite the question you asked, but it's really I think similar to what we're talking about here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, back to Chinua, this idea then of you know, the blinders and navigating doubt. What have you seen that's made some teams succeed versus others? How does that blinders and navigating doubt play into it?
Well, I think, I mean, for us, I would always come back to the beginning, which is talking to your customers, right? Mm-hmm. So I think, as you know, you can navigate a lot and navigate it well if you continue to keep that open stream of communication. Mm. I think once you stop doing that and start, again, kind of building an isolation, then you run into trouble. So if you can stay close to your customer, you know, as we call it, and stay close to your customer through that whole process, you know, while keeping the faith and keeping your vision and, you know, keeping everything moving in a forward direction, but constantly having that checkpoint, you know, that touch point of talking to your customers and getting feedback along the way, then I think you do have a better chance, at least, of avoiding some of the pitfalls. And even, like I said, even if the advice is this is never going to work, and your ability to hear that, I mean, I think in the Theranos example, again, you know, one of the very critical points at which things went wrong was Elizabeth's inability to hear that, right? Mm. Many people told her, this is not your vision for this company is not going to work from a technical standpoint. And she couldn't hear that and couldn't kind of pivot and adjust. Had she simply adjusted to what was feasible at the time and really promoted that as a first product, she probably wouldn't have put the company in the situation that she did.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Do you have anything to add to that, Dr. Hall?
Well, it's interesting also because if you think going back to the pharmaceutical example, the customer on some level is the patient or the doctor or the insurance agent or the insurance company, the health insurance company. And what's interesting about talking to your patients is it's not a one-way flow of information. So in this case, when you talk to your patient, you could actually, because of placebo effects, sway their belief about the treatment and potentially influence an outcome. Mm-hmm. So I think it's a fascinating, you know, question, like how do you interact with your customers when they're patients and you're trying to make a drug? Mm-hmm. And, you know, obviously I think the probably you more interact with the physicians and people tend to interact less with the patients unless, you know, they interact also through patient groups. But I think that even patient groups nowadays are, you know, are doing an amazing job advocating for patients, and they're creating a forum for patients to kind of talk to each other. And that's ironically disrupting the kind of old paradigm of a blinded, randomized clinical control trial. So people are kind of unblinding themselves to whether or not they're on placebo and potentially changing their outcomes. So, I mean, it just adds a layer of complexity when you're talking about that particular industry. But I also, so, I think you always have to think about who is your customer and how do you interact with them, and how can you get the information that's going to guide you and maybe sometimes give the customer placebo effect outside the context of the pharmaceutical industry. You know, I think if you look at the Theranos example, to go back to that, she definitely gave people that placebo belief, right? Mm-hmm. It's just that she didn't have anything to back it up. Like, had she had a product, you know, that went with all of that, I think it would have been really compelling. But so I guess, you know, in some industries you call that selling. In other industries, you call that, you know, building expectation or building faith in the product. So it's really interesting that interaction with your customer, how it gets translated, either in development of your drug or the impression of the customer.
Hmm. Yeah, well, I think that's interesting in that we talk to our entrepreneurs a lot about bias, obviously, and this is kind of the same issue, right? And how do you strip bias out of the equation? And it's very difficult, especially, you know, when you're sitting kind of inside of the development process, right? It's very hard to understand how you might be asking questions in a certain way, you know, leading the witness, so to speak, wanting certain conclusions, you know, and therefore presenting a certain case. You know, something that entrepreneurs do a lot is, I have this great product. Why don't you take a look at it and tell me what you think? Well, you've already biased the witness, right?
Right.
Already feeling like, well, I better tell. I'm not going to tell you your baby's ugly, you know, because you already told me that this is so great. And I'm a human, and you're a human, and I want to tell you what you want to hear. And clearly, you want to hear that it's great too. So that's probably what I'm going to tell you. So it is really hard to get unbiased information, and that's why, you know, we really encourage our entrepreneurs to kind of rewind all the way back to the beginning of that conversation if they can, and have, you know, ask open-ended questions like, what is your current problem set? How are you solving it now? You know, things like that, very kind of open-ended, so that you're not leading them down a path that just kind of gives you the answers that you're looking for.
Yeah, it's interesting, because when I was starting a first business many years ago, and it was, I definitely had a lot of blinders on, and always thought my product was the best. And I had to definitely, you know, forget a lot of things that happened the day before, so I would keep going, you know, and it was almost like I had to, you know, feed myself a lot of placebos, you know.
There's a whole phenomenon, if you will, called, I don't know if you know about the Hawthorne effect, which is one type of placebo response. But in the 1950s, Henry Landsberger did this study at the Hawthorne Works Company, which was a subsidiary of Weston Electric. And they felt like adding light made the workers work more effectively. Adding light increased productivity. And then they decided to test this theory without the light. And what they found was, actually, it didn't matter the light or no light. It was just this observing the workers made them work more efficiently. And so they coined the term Hawthorne effect, which is essentially what you're saying is kind of this, you know, you're being observed, or you're having this interaction, and there's this level of needing to please or needing to demonstrate an effect that's expected.
Mm-hmm. Now, how do you think we can use this idea expectations and placebo, like even from like a leadership perspective, it seems, you know, if you have a vision, you want to get buy-in on. And I think a lot of times when I think of like an entrepreneur, I'm thinking of someone who has a vision they're trying to get buy-on in. So there's a lot of like leadership qualities there. On some level, we use the placebo kind of that concept all the time as a leader to get people to take action towards a vision. What are your thoughts on that?
Absolutely. I think we use it all the time. I think we use it constantly all day long. I think the placebo effect is not something that belongs in clinical trials or belongs in the clinical setting. It's a phenomenon that we were able to observe very clearly in a clinical setting, and we're able to give, you know, a specific name. But I think it's a behavioral / neurological pathway that we use all the time. Hmm. One of the things that we've found in these open label placebo studies, and what that is basically, I don't know if you know, but after World War II, and when we started to use placebos in clinical trials and we found they had these big effects, whereas before World War II, a physician could give a patient a bread pill or, you know, colored water or something, and it was okay. After that, the belief was that you couldn't give a patient a placebo because you had to deceive them to give them the placebo, and deception was unethical. And so essentially, they were physicians who gave them, you know, quote unquote, by the bushels, were no longer able to give people placebos. And what we've done in the last 5 to 10 years is we've started to do open label placebo trials. And Ted Kapchuk is the leader of this at Harvard Medical School. And what they're studying is, can you give a patient a pill, tell them it's a placebo, and tell them honestly what we know about placebos? And I think what this, and they're finding really significant effects. And I think what this underscores is that a couple of things. One is that it's important for the patient to trust the physician in this context, but also it's important for the physician to be honest and to say that, you know, what they know about the truth, to not exaggerate it and say, you know, you're going to get better for sure. Or because people know, you know, whether they know consciously, they on some subconscious level, they know what, you know, when somebody is, you know, they can always go back and say, oh yeah, you know, I kind of felt weird about what they were saying. So I think, you know, people know. And then the next thing is, very interesting, is you don't want to, whether you're telling the truth, well, certainly as you tell the truth and say, you know, this works in about 42% of people, so there's a chance that you might actually have a complete recovery with this treatment. The thing that's really fascinating about this is that our brains love a little bit of doubt. Because what doubt does is it encourages to check in on the data. So, you know, I could say to you, you know, Tyler, you're gonna be really sleepy after after this session, and you're gonna be like, at some point you're gonna be like, huh, I feel kind of sleepy. Oh wow, Catherine did say I was gonna be sleepy, and you're gonna confirm that seed that was planted. That seed of, you know, that little doubt, that little question. And that's, people use that a lot. I mean, I'm not saying you want to use it inappropriately. And certainly people, as you can imagine, in our current political climate, there's a lot of signaling and suggestion that gets reinforced through many different ways in the public setting. But certainly there are ways to I think, legitimately and ethically use that ability to reach people in a positive way.
Just to kind of summarize, you're saying that they've done studies on placebo, and even if a doctor, physician, tells a patient it's a placebo, there's no drug here to do anything really, but there's a chance it could help. And just being honest and truthful, it actually turns out that it does still work.
Yeah, and you know, this shouldn't be surprising, because if you think about it, right, we think that placebos work because people think it's the real drug, right? What you're doing is you're saying to them, like, this placebo works in a subset of people and it might work in you, which is true. That's all true. But it allows the patient to, it allows the possibility, and then it kind of allows the patient to check in on their symptoms and attribute them to placebo.
You know, a lot of times with entrepreneurs, it seems like when they're selling their dream, you know, they're trying to fudge the data a little bit, right? Make it seem more successful than it is, or that it can do more than it can. But it also seems like here that if there's a correlation, then maybe being more honest about what they're offering would get the same results.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's absolutely a correlation, right? I mean, what we want our entrepreneurs to do is to be honest, but again, have confidence. I think that's really what people pick up on. It's kind of like the power of suggestion, right? Mm-hmm. With the placebo effect. It's if you really own this business and you really know everything about it and you're passionate about it, then you're going to convey that message in a way that, you know, is very believable, you know, that might require me to take a leap of faith, but I trust that you're going to be the person to get me there. Mm-hmm. And once you, and on the flip side, once you break that trust, it's nearly impossible to get it back. So I tell entrepreneurs all the time, if you get busted in some little half-truth or exaggeration, or God forbid a lie outright, it's over, game over. That conversation ends. So, because trust, especially between entrepreneurs and investors, for example, is so important. So you have to kind of, again, walk that fine line and bring a lot of confidence to your game and lead people to a conclusion that is positive. You know, you can't say, oh, gee, I'm not sure if that's going to work out, or, well, you know, we're still looking into that, or, you know, have those, that kind of phraseology really like turns people off, right? They go, I don't believe you, and I don't think that you're going to be able to pull this off. So you have to kind of instill this confidence, but at the same time, be very truthful and straightforward in your answers to questions and the data you're providing, all of that. Because once you've established, I'm a trustworthy person, then people are willing to give you a lot more benefit of the doubt, right?
I really like that combination of confidence and honesty. It, you know, it just seems like that's the right note to hit.
Yeah, it seems like, you know, and even part of the work of, I think, a leader and even, you know, a physician, a lot of times it's helping to instill that confidence in, you know, their patient or their employees or team members. Absolutely. As well.
Absolutely. I remember it's just an anecdote, but when I was trying to get pregnant, I went to a fertility expert, and the first thing he said to me is, we're going to have this baby. And I was like, oh, wow. Okay. Like, yeah, we're going to have this baby. And it's just, everything
That's
changed,
great.
You know,
yeah.
Just from,
wow.
Just from that confidence that he instilled in me. And then I started having more confidence in myself and my body and everything, you know, it was kind of like that placebo effect on steroids, right? It just kind of changed everything. So I think it's very, very powerful stuff, right? If you can strike the right chord there.
You see that the same in Dr. Hall and physicians as well, then, and their patients?
Yeah, I mean, I think that it really, again, varies with the patient. And some patients, you know, are less trusting because of their past experiences, and some people are looking for something to trust, someone to trust. And some physicians are more confident in the treatment, or confident in treatments in general because of their experience with them. And, you know, reasonably, they're less confident in some treatment, a new treatment or a treatment that has had problems. And so, you know, I think a good physician can kind of sense what kind of dose of honesty and confidence is best for this patient. Within obviously ethical bounds, and can kind of modulate that with different patients, which comes back to where we started, where I think a good leader is somebody, you know, a good physician, a good leader, a good entrepreneur is somebody who really understands themselves and understands the person or the people that they are interacting with, and can kind of, in an honest and confident and real way, modulate their message, modulate their interaction for the, you know, for the greatest value for both them and the patient or the customer.
Yeah, and as you were talking about, experience matters a lot in both these cases too, right? So a physician that has a lot of experience with success can say that with more confidence. And this is the same with an entrepreneur. This is why serial entrepreneurs are so much more likely to succeed. You know, they've had an experience. Whether positive or negative actually doesn't matter. The data tells us that your second time around is going to have a better outcome more likely than the first, even if your first was a failure, because you've learned, you know, all of those lessons along the way, and you've learned what you can and can't kind of deliver on. And those are really important lessons. You know, entrepreneurs often get in over their heads and kind of overpromise and underdeliver, right? And and those are lessons you learn the hard way and not to repeat.
Yeah, it seems like these ideas like we're getting at here, like honesty, confidence, trustworthiness, experience, those are like essential in the, I think, a future which is very uncertain and complex and exponentially changing. Because when you have those things, it'll really help to, you know, ease a lot of the uncertainty and deal with complexity and help manage the change. For each of you, just have like a final thought after today's dialogue on this idea of what leaders need to have or what they can do to be intelligent about the future. So Chanel, if you want to start.
Well, it's just a thought that came up while we were speaking. Certainly in my world, I find that there are certain populations that are grossly underrepresented, such as women and minorities. And one of the reasons for that is that, you know, they have gotten mixed messages about how to do this work. So how to present an idea with confidence and with honesty, right? And I think that is something that anyone can learn, but it's not something that necessarily comes naturally to certain groups and populations. So I think it's a real part of kind of, in my mind, a part of leveling the playing field for opportunity for everyone, is to kind of get that message out and to work with folks on kind of being their best self in that context.
So this idea of leaders helping people who are typically underrepresented or not usually heard, giving them the confidence to be heard, to share their ideas.
Yeah, I mean, just anecdotally, I find a lot of these kind of underrepresented populations, let's say in the entrepreneurial world, female founders are, you know, rare. They are often much more competent, but they do lack confidence. And they, you know, so we have to work with them on that. And the flip side can also be true, where we have, you know, our male colleagues that tend to be a little overly confident, you know, a little less truthful. And that hurts them just as much. So we kind of we work on both of those populations in terms of getting to a place where they're, you know, presenting their best self and putting their best foot forward in terms of their opportunities to succeed.
And Dr. Hall, any last thoughts?
I have to now say that as an underrepresented minority, both as a woman and as a woman, African-American woman, that I agree with Chanel that it's challenging sometimes to stand up in a room or in an audience or in a, you know, a setting where people might be not necessarily hearing you, or there's a, you know, they have a lens kind of up in front of them, they're hearing things through this filter. And you know, I just want to share that what's worked for me is to understand that failure is possible, and it's also possible to work through it, because I think with and that I think comes from experience, where you kind of you know, this didn't work, but you kept going and now this worked. And so you can take the lessons from both and understand what to do next. And I think building, instead of kind of getting stuck at the places where you lack support or things didn't work, you find a group of people around you that are supportive, that can do the postmortem on something that didn't work, and you gather yourself up and you move forward and you go ahead. And I think when you have that in your back pocket, that experience and that, you know, that not that reduced fear of failure, and then you throw in that surrounding yourself with a good supportive team, I think that you can go a little bit further, you know, because this is an incremental process. And I think it's, you know, it's one foot in front of the other, one day at a time, so to speak.
And finally, just to wrap up, one, if you could both share just one word that future leaders need to embrace or embody. So, Chinoa?
That's empowerment. That's the first thing that came to me.
Dr. Hall?
Resilience. I'm going to go with resilience.
Well, thank you, Chinoa and Dr. Hall, for joining me today on the Futures Intelligent Leadership Flowcast. I really appreciate you taking the time and energy to share your insights and your ideas with me and today's listeners. Thank you for joining us today on the Flowcast. To get a summary of today's dialogue, find out more about today's guests, listen to previous episodes, or discover more about Haku Global's neuroscience-based Futures Intelligent Leadership programs or customized strategic foresight and innovation sprints, visit us at www.haku.global. At Haku Global, we believe it is time for more futures intelligent leadership. The future is something we need to think more intelligently and feel more deeply about so we can collaborate to discover today's solutions for future problems. If you are in a leadership role and need support or training to scale futures intelligence across your organization, then contact us at Haku Global. This is your host, Tyler Mongan, and until next time, have a preferred and conscious future. Aloha.